Good morning. My name is Jack Park. I'm the chair of the Professional Responsibility Legal Education Practice Group, which is sponsoring this panel. And the panel is on what role should judges have in choosing their successor. This whole conference is organized around what we look at, the state of legal education, the state of the legal practice, the state of the bar, and its regulatory authority. And it puts me in mind of something they said about Yale Law School. The jibe is, I can do meta better than you. And so what we've been looking at in the big discussions is from a high level of generality, and we drill down to look at other issues. Second thing, you know, what this is basically is how does a Mandarin class replicate itself? That's to say, not to say that federal judges are our only Mandarins, but it's about what role does a Mandarin class have in preserving itself. And the third thing I'd say is, if you want to be a federal judge, what you've got to do is A, know your senators. Two, be on their side. And three, you have to keep in mind that you're not the one to pick, and only one person can sit in the chair. So what you've got to do is find a thunderstorm with lightning, put your umbrella in the air, and pray, hit me, hit me. So what? At the end, if the subjects that we deal with are of interest to you, please feel free to talk to me afterwards. We'd be delighted to have your help. I'd like to introduce our moderator, Judge Stephen Vaden. Judge Vaden serves as a judge on the United States Court of International Trade. He was confirmed by the United States Senate on November 18, 2020, and appointed by President Donald J. Trump on December 21, 2020. Before joining the court, Judge Vaden served as general counsel of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Cycling back, Judge Anderson is a native of Union City, Tennessee, and grew up helping with his family's farms and real estate ventures, so he's very familiar with agriculture. Judge Vaden supervised more than 250 legal professionals in 13 offices across the United States who handled all kinds of legal matters on behalf of a department with more than 100,000 employees and an annual budget approaching $150 billion. During his nearly four-year term as head of the Office of General Counsel, the department won two cases before the United States Supreme Court, relocated and reorganized the agencies that comprise the department to better serve rural America, engaged in substantial regulatory reform, and developed new regulations to allow for the legal sale of hemp and the labeling of bioengineered products, and implemented the 2018 Farm Bill. Judge Vaden also served as a member of the board of the Commodity Credit Corporation, a government corporation devoted to helping American agricultural producers. During his tenure from 2017 to 2020, the board developed programs to assist American producers affected by foreign trade barriers. In private practice, Judge Vaden worked for the Jones Day and Patton Boggs law firms. At both, he was an appellate litigator and part of the firm's political law practices. And with this, I'll hand it off to Judge Vaden. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you so much. Well, today we're going to talk about ethics, but we're going to talk about it in a fun way. I don't know about you, but whenever I sit in an ethics panel, you're probably better than I am. But I would sit back there, and as the people would speak, I would think, have I done that? I didn't know that was unethical. I better write that down. But today, you're going to have the pleasure of listening to an ethics talk, which, unless you are a federal judge, which I see a few in here, but if you're not one of them, it's not going to affect you at all. So that means you can sit back, make moral judgments about other people, and feel morally superior, and still earn your CLE credit, which I know is very important. Speaking of your CLE credit, I know that's why you're here, and ensure that you have signed in using the QR code so you get counted by your state. Today's topic is a very interesting one. We're going to be talking about the ethical implications of judges getting involved in potentially picking who succeeds them. Under the Constitution, as you know, two branches of government are formally involved in the selection of federal judges. The president makes the nomination. The Senate confirms, followed by the presidential appointment. Yet the third branch of government, the judiciary, often plays a role in that process, and federal judges can influence the selection of other judges. The influence can manifest itself in several ways. For example, judges can reach an understanding with the executive branch to take senior status if the president nominates a specific person to fill that vacancy. Or, rather than taking senior status at a date certain, a judge can condition his status change on the confirmation of his successor. Third, judges who reach such an understanding and who are not satisfied with the president's ultimate nomination can and have rescinded their decision to take senior status. And then to add the cherry on top of today's discussion, D.C., which always stands out as a singularity, there is a sitting federal judge, who actually chairs the committee that nominates judges to the D.C. local courts, the D.C. Superior Court and the D.C. Court of Appeals. There are a whole host of ethical obligations and pitfalls that these actions involve, and we're going to be talking about them today. But before we talk about them, I just want to lay out one thing on behalf of the panel that is going to underlay most of what they have to talk about, and that is, what is senior status and how does one attain it? And the answer, unfortunately for lawyers, involves a little bit of math. It is called the Rule of 80, and it's quite simple. Take whatever age you are once you hit 65. Add the number of years that you have served on the bench, and if it is 80 or more, you may take senior status. Senior status involves still serving as a federal judge, still getting that annual cost of living increase in your salary, but taking a reduced caseload. And if you are a trial judge, it comes with the benefit of saying, if you wish during senior status, you're not going to hear a particular subset of cases. Maybe you don't like patent, or maybe you don't like criminal, or maybe you only want to hear criminal. You can do that once you take senior status and still receive your full salary. So the Rule of 80 is going to underpin everything that we have to talk about here today. And here to talk about it today, we have four wonderful panelists. And I think if you look across the room, I think we have the youngest average age of a FedSoc panel of anything at this convention, or perhaps any other convention this organization has ever had.
Is that diversity, Steve, or no?
I think it counts. So in other words, our hair is all here and all original. I'm going to get a letter about that. As we look at our next generation here, first up will be Rob Luther. Rob is of counsel at Jones Day, but before that, he was an associate White House counsel handling nominations for President Trump, both executive branch nominations and judicial nominations. He also assisted with the transition. And to fill his time, he's also a member of the faculty of the Antonin Scalia Law School at George Mason University. Following Rob will be David Latt. David really doesn't need much of an introduction, but he is a Yale alumnus like I am. But more importantly, he authors Original Jurisdiction on Substack, and he is the originator and creator of the Above the Law and prior to that Underneath Their Robes websites, which has opened up judiciary and everything that goes on for public consumption. Next will be Michael Fregoso. Michael serves as chief counsel to Republican leader Mitch McConnell. In that role, he advises the leader on nominations for the judiciary, as well as constitutional issues. Prior to his service with the leader, Michael served as Deputy Assistant Attorney General of the Office of Legal Policy, which is also involved in judicial nominations for the Department of Justice. He graduated from Notre Dame Law School and clerked for a judge on the Seventh Circuit, Diane Sykes. And we will last, but certainly not least, don't let his hair fool you. Josh Blackman.
It's all real.
Josh Blackman is an erudite scholar, professor of law at South Texas College of Law. He blogs at the Volokh Conspiracy, frequently on issues involving the judiciary and the propriety of what goes on there. He's a public legal intellectual, and he also graduated from George Mason University Law School while clerking for Judge Boggs. So without any further ado, let's go to Rob Luther to kick things off.
Thank you to the Federalist Society and to Judge Vaden for inviting me to speak. Thomas Jefferson allegedly said that the problem with life tenure for judges is that few die and none resign. Given that quote, I think you'd be surprised at the level of interest we've seen in judicial retirements over the last few years. So I'm going to start by identifying the three main issues people have raised regarding the ethics of succession planning on the federal judiciary, and then offer my take on these issues. So issue number one, may a judge appropriately condition her retirement upon the White House's naming of the judge's preferred successor? My friend David wrote in the Wall Street Journal that for a judge to condition his retirement on the appointment of a particular successor, that's inappropriate. Canon 5 of the Code of Conduct for U.S. Judges requires federal judges to refrain from political activity and selecting judicial nominees, a task the Constitution assigns to elected officials, is inherently political. I agree with David that for a judge to condition his retirement on the appointment of a particular successor is inappropriate. However, I think that conclusion is best grounded in Canon 2B, which prohibits lending the prestige of the judicial office to advance the private interests of others, not Canon 5, where David finds it. I believe David's view of Canon 5 is overly restrictive. If, as he argues, selecting judicial nominees is inherently political and thus prohibited, then judges can't participate in any dimension of the replacement process without violating Canon 5. But that's not the law, nor is it practical. On the law, the commentary to Canon 2B permits judges to participate in the selection process and to cooperate with screening authorities and selection committees. Judge Katsas cites numerous other examples of these sorts of sources of authority on page 9 of his judicial counsel dissent that Josh will discuss later. Practically speaking, it only makes sense that judges are able to provide recommendations if asked by the nominating authority because the White House wants as much information as possible to make the best decision. When we were in the White House, some press criticized us for taking recommendations from certain people or groups, but we considered recommendations from anyone who had anything intelligent to say. We looked at thousands of resumes, we conducted hundreds of interviews, we accepted applications from the general public. There were probably 24 people involved in this process at the White House and DOJ. We were not hard to find. Because our picks were based exclusively on merit to the extent the politics permitted it, we talked to a lot of people, and those people included judges. And of course, the ABA process allows talking to judges in its process as well. So again, if David is right that a sitting judge sharing her views on a prospective nominee is political activity, then people involved in this process and the general public will lose a lot of meaningful information. Frankly, I don't think Canon 5's ban on political activity applies to any of the topics we're discussing today. That canon prohibits judges from holding office in a political organization, making speeches for political candidates or publicly endorsing them, and soliciting money or spending it on political candidates. Rather, I believe that a judge explicitly conditioning her seat on a particular successor or a judge serving on a commission that forces the president to nominate a judicial candidate, as Josh will discuss, is improper under Canon 2B, which prohibits lending the prestige of judicial office to advance the private interests of others. Because obviously, if a judge is conditioning her retirement on a specific successor, she would be using her office to advance that successor's interests. All right, now issue number two. May a judge appropriately condition her retirement on the confirmation of her successor? Yes, absolutely. A conditional retirement letter is completely justified based on both pragmatic realities and precedent. Pragmatic realities. Conditional retirement letters are justified on their face because they prevent the court from being short-staffed until a successor is confirmed by the Senate and appointed by the president. As Judge Vaden mentioned earlier, because senior district judges can choose what kind of cases they hear, Some stop hearing civil or criminal cases altogether when they assume senior status. If they do so prior to the confirmation of their successor, that could put a real burden on their court, particularly if it's a small district and there's only a few judges. I don't think anyone can really disagree with the public benefit of that position, and I imagine it's the reason some judges started taking conditional senior status in the first place. Precedent. Conditional retirement letters are nothing new. They've been submitted by judges and justices appointed by presidents of both parties for at least a few decades. But no administration has seen the proliferation of letters containing this language teed up for it like the Biden administration. More on that in a minute. Supreme Court justices of presidents appointed by both parties have used conditional retirement language. Justice O'Connor submitted her decision to retire upon the confirmation of her successor. And Justice Breyer wrote, "I intend this decision to take effect when the court rises for the summer recess this year, typically late June or early July, assuming that by then my successor has been nominated and confirmed." We've also seen this language in lower courts by judges appointed by presidents of both parties. According to the Vetting Room blog, the first recorded lower court letter containing the upon the confirmation of my successor language was submitted by a Seventh Circuit judge in the early years of the George W. Bush administration. A few district judges followed, and as did a circuit judge during the Bush administration. But since George W. Bush, more and more judges have used this conditional language. 5 did so during the Obama administration. 15 circuit judges did so during the first 2 years of the Trump administration. And 20 judges have done so in the first 2 years of the Biden administration. So does the fact that more than 50% of the Biden administration's circuit seats will be made available upon the confirmation of their successor raise any ethical issues? I don't think so. As previously explained, Canon 2B prevents judges from naming a specific successor because they would be using the judicial office to promote the interests of that successor. Canon B also prevents a judge from allowing family, social, political, financial, or other relationships to influence judicial conduct or judgment. Now, one may argue that conditioning retirement on the confirmation of the judge's successor is allowing political relationships to influence judicial conduct. But as Chief Justice Rehnquist famously said in 2003, it is not inappropriate for a justice to take into account the party or politics of a sitting president when deciding whether to step down from the court, because deciding when to step down from the court is not a judicial act. Third and finally, issue number 3. May a judge appropriately withdraw her conditional retirement based on her disapproval with the proposed successor? There are two parts to this issue: whether a judge can withdraw her conditional retirement generally, and then whether she can do so based on her disapproval with a proposed successor. On the question of whether a judge can withdraw her conditional retirement generally, the answer is yes. A 1974 OLC opinion states that a resignation to take effect in the future may be withdrawn prior to its effective date. This OLC opinion was drafted when a federal judge sought to retire due to disability and tendered his retirement letter to the president. But prior to acceptance by the president, the judge received further medical advice that he was not disabled. He sought to withdraw his letter, and OLC concluded he could do so because it wasn't yet accepted. This was the right result. There are numerous valid motivations for why a judge may change her mind about retirement. Here, a disability was wrongly diagnosed, or one may recover from a health issue. While there appears to be a strong interest in Democrat-appointed circuit judges being replaced by the same during the Biden administration, there does not appear to be any widespread concern with those judges about who replaces them. This suggests to me that while some judges prefer to retire when the party that appointed them holds the White House and the Senate, it's only the smallest percentage that are truly concerned with the individual who succeeds them. Indeed, these are the conclusions supported by the evidence. In the past 15 years, there have been somewhere around 750 Article III judicial appointments. Over that period, a total of 2 federal judges have withdrawn their conditional retirement letters. That's the same number of federal judges, 2, who have been impeached over this period of time. That's 0.0026%, so hardly an epidemic. It happened once during the Trump administration, and in that case, a judge withdrew his retirement letter because he thought his successor was wronged when the administration declined to nominate him for political reasons. And it happened once in the Biden administration, allegedly due to the judge's dissatisfaction with the administration's proposed successor. It almost happened a second time during the Biden administration based on concerns that the successor judge would not have his courthouse in the retiring judge's jurisdiction, but apparently that was a misunderstanding. So what do I think when a judge who has conditionally retired withdraws the letter because she doesn't like who her successor is likely to be? I think that's fine because Canon 2B only prohibits lending the prestige of judicial office to advance the private interests of others. In other words, while Canon 2B prohibits a judge from conditioning his seat on his favored successor, it doesn't prohibit the judge from exercising a veto over his disfavored successor. Now, you might think that withdrawing a retirement letter based on a proposed successor and effectively exercising a judicial veto causes a separation of powers problem because the judiciary is encroaching on the president's power to nominate. But clawing back a retirement letter for whatever reason, family health or dissatisfaction with a successor, does not implicate the separation of powers because the withdrawal only frustrates the timing of the decision, and the executive branch has no authority with respect to the timing of a judicial retirement. Hence, Jefferson's frustration with the fact that few judges die and none resign. Now, there have been some suggestions that Congress should act to force more uniformity into judicial retirements, but I think that any congressionally imposed restrictions, such as requiring a retirement letter to announce a fixed and irrevocable date certain, as David suggests in the Wall Street Journal, or making resignation letters formally binding, as Professor Richard Ray of UVA suggests in the Iowa Law Review Online, would contradict existing precedent, the aforementioned OLC opinion, decades of practice, and I would venture Article III itself. Finally, I have to wonder how serious these concerns about judicial vetoes really are in light of the Judicial Council for the DC Circuit's opinion on judicial misconduct that Josh will discuss shortly. If a sitting federal district judge for the District of Columbia can make the president pick one of his three proposed candidates, I'm not sure why a sitting judge can't veto a president's proposed successor. If the Judicial Council believes it's okay to empower federal judges to make the president pick future federal judges, it seems consistent with my understanding of the separation of powers that for federal judges to occasionally stand in the president's way. Thank you.
With the table having been set, David, the floor is yours.
Okay. Thank you so much. It's great to be here at the National Lawyers Conference. And I have to say, I am particularly pleased to be speaking about this topic. I do a lot of events around the country for Federalist Society student and lawyer chapters. And typically, the topics I've been asked to address recently have been hot button issues like wokeness and cancel culture and free speech and affirmative action. But this type of topic about a judge's involvement in picking their successor, this is the stuff I love about the Federalist Society, because this is really the stuff that lets us nerd out. And basically, congratulations to all of you, because you're the nerdiest of the nerds. This is not some red meat political thing. You actually are really interested in what is the appropriate outcome under the law, and so I have to salute you. Also, I have to say, credit to all of you for being here, because I know we're up against some very sexy panels like West Virginia v. EPA and Bruin and Guns, and even my husband said, would you mind if I went to the Bruin panel? Yes. So it is, again, really wonderful to see so many people in this room to talk about such a wonky little topic. So let me lay out a couple of thoughts here, and again, as Rob was mentioning, you can find some deeper thoughts or more extensive ones in the, this is CLE credit, including, I think, ethics credit. So there are materials online, and one of them is an article, an op-ed for the Wall Street Journal that Lori Lin and I wrote addressing this issue and talking about the inappropriateness of some things that some judges have either done or attempted to do. And there are, I would say, two distinct but related issues. One, is it legal or constitutional as a matter of separation of powers, for example, which I know is very important to many of the people in this room, for judges to play these types of games with their retirements or going senior? And second, is it ethical from the point of view of judicial ethics? So I'll go through the questions that Rob also went through, but I would, on the nature or scope of the problem, like to say that I think the problem is more serious than Rob pointed out. By my count, and again, it depends on how you characterize these things, I would say that there have been four instances where judges have tried to play funny games with their departures or their going senior, and what's striking about it is these four instances have all happened within the past 4 years. So, although I agree with Rob that this has not been a major problem over the past few decades, I think that's partly because for decades, nobody thought it was appropriate to do this kind of thing. And then suddenly in the past few years, judges have started doing this. And if we don't address the problem, and we can talk about how to address it, but if we don't address the problem, it's only going to get worse because judges are just going to feel emboldened. And again, the materials go into these particular cases, but I'll just mention the situations briefly and you can run Google searches or what have you. But I think it's actually very interesting, and you're here in this room, so you probably do too. One was Judge Kaney of the Seventh Circuit, who had a situation where the White House essentially said, well, if you retire, we'll appoint your former clerk, Tom Fisher, who's the Indiana SG. And then apparently some folks in Mike Pence's office got a little troubled by this because there was a fear or a concern that having a Fisher's confirmation could create some political drama for Pence. And so in the end, they said they wouldn't be nominating Tom Fisher. And then Judge Kaney said, thanks, but no thanks, I'm staying on the bench. So that was one issue. That was in 2018. Judge Kaney actually subsequently passed away, and now his seat actually is going to be filled by the Obama administration. The second issue involved Judge... I'm correct about that, right? Yeah, I think.
Biden. Technically not president.
Biden.
Wow, sorry. That's really funny. Is that a Freudian slip?
That's the sort of thing I'm supposed to say.
You know, I guess I would say, I mean, personally, and I have to admit, I guess I'm the liberal on the panel. You know, I probably have more affection for President Obama than, like, anyone else in this room. So, and I think I probably have warmer feelings towards President Obama than President Biden. So anyway, maybe that was my wishful thinking about that. But anyway, be that as it may. So, yes, it's now going to be filled by the Biden administration. So the second issue involved Judge Robert King, who was of the Fourth Circuit. And this was a situation where he essentially announced that he would go senior upon confirmation of a successor. And then apparently he didn't really like the successor, and then he took it back. The third instance, which didn't involve an official announcement or letter to the president, but it involved media interviews, essentially, Judge Johnny Rawlinson of the Ninth Circuit essentially said something like, I'm 69 and I feel great, but you know, I could totally move to senior status if maybe you picked my clerk. And she said this in media interviews, and she actually approached the clerk before she even talked to anyone in the political branches or the media and said, hey, how would you like my job? And the clerk said, great. And then that's when Judge Rawlinson went on this little media campaign. I think the senators of Nevada said, well, we have a process for this, and we have these commissions, so no thank you, Judge Rawlinson. So there's actually no official vacancy there. But again, the fact that Judge Rawlinson felt that she could do this just seems so brazen. It's just kind of a sign that we need to get back to earth here. And then the final situation involved Judge David Hurd in the Northern District of New York. And this was, again, a situation where he actually sent President Biden a letter saying, I am going to go senior. President Biden nominated Jorge Rodriguez, who works in the New York AG's office. And then I guess that didn't sit well with Judge Hurd. So he said, well, I want my successor to sit in Utica. By the way, this was not originally a Utica vicinage seat. This used to be Albany. Judge Hurd moved it to Utica for his personal reasons. So then nominee Rodriguez said, fine, I'm happy with Utica. And then Judge Hurd said, sorry, I have unconditionally withdrawn my going senior Utica or no Utica. So again, I just think that's really, this just really leaves a bad taste in one's mouth. So let me just quickly address the points of the questions that Rob addressed. And here we may not have actually that much sort of formal or official disagreement, but I think we have some disagreements of degree. The first is, may a judge condition her retirement upon the White House naming her preferred replacement? I think the obvious answer is no, but see Judge Rawlinson. Some people think it's appropriate. Second, may a judge condition retirement upon the confirmation of a successor, leaving the ability to withdraw? So here I do agree with Rob. I think, yes, this is okay. It is widely done today. Many nominations are now, many takings of senior status are made dependent upon confirmation of a successor. And there are advantages to this. You get a judge remaining in active service until there's actually somebody willing to take that active seat. This is good for judicial economy and having a fully staffed bench, so I get that. But what I do think here is dangerous is there is a potential for abuse. There is a potential for manipulation, and I really, really don't like these takebacks. And again, I don't know that it's necessarily the best thing to pass a law or something, but I do wish that we would have sort of an informal norm that this is very, very frowned upon to retract one's decision to go senior. And as Lori and I talked about in the Wall Street Journal, maybe there should be some amendments to the Code of Judicial Ethics, where the judiciary itself says, we have some problems with this, we don't think this is appropriate, even if we don't think Congress should be mucking around in this. And then on the third question, may a judge appropriately withdraw conditional retirement if the judge disapproves of their successor, and note the adjective there, appropriately, I don't really think that that is appropriate. Again, I recognize the OLC opinion, and I don't think there's any kind of legal action that could be taken over this, but I really don't think it's appropriate for the judge to say, I'm going to go senior. Oh, you picked that person? Sorry, I'm not going to go senior. And on the issue of what provision of the canons we should be focused on. I agree that it does violate canon 2, and I think it is very troubling in terms of promoting personal interests of the judge. And in the situations I've mentioned, I think in most of those situations, there was an issue where the judge wanted their clerk, had a former clerk who was their favorite candidate, and that very much seems like almost a nepotistic thing. I liked whoever, Laurie and I didn't come up with it, but whoever was, I salute the copy editor at the Wall Street Journal editorial page who gave the title for our piece, which is "Federal Courts Are Not Royal Ones." These seats are not things to be passed on like personal property. A judge's legacy should rest in his or her work, and the seat and the allocation of that should be left to the president and the Senate, which is where the Constitution puts it. And I would point out that the advice and consent clause that governs this isn't even in Article 3, it's in Article 2. This is a sign, a reflection of the fact that this is really a presidential prerogative with the advice and consent of the Senate. And in terms of Canon 5, where Rob says, well, do we want judges to be entirely shut out of the process? I call your bluff. I have no problem with that. Do I know that some judges informally call up the White House and say, hey, Rob, my ex-clerk would be great for this? Yes, and maybe sometimes the judges have valuable input. They know the bench. They know their former clerk. But I don't think that having that door shut off is going to be this great, great loss to the process if we just say, just in terms of avoiding any kind of impropriety or appearance of impropriety, judges should not be picking up the phone to privately tell the White House counsel's office that their former clerk would be great. I have no problem with that. I have no problem with reading Canon 5 in that way. Josh is going to get into this a little bit more, but I would refer you to Judge Silberman's objections to what Josh is going to talk about regarding Judge Sullivan. Judge Silberman, the late brilliant Judge Silberman, he also grounded his objections in Canon 5 and how this is inherently political. And so finally, in closing, I just think this is a very troubling thing. Again, is it the end of the world? No, it's something that just, you know, a bunch of people who are, you know, admittedly nerdy do care about. But I do think that if we don't nip this trend in the bud, it could become something very problematic. And so I'm very glad that you're all here to talk about it and we're all here to focus on it. And I hope that some people can at least be publicly shamed, even if we have no rule or statutory change, into not playing these kinds of games. Thank you.
One thing I will note, David, in response to your comments, is the commentary on Canon 2B actually is very clear with regard to the point that you made there at the end, and it agrees with you. It is ethically inappropriate for a judge to initiate communications regarding his successor. So I don't know whether anyone does it, but it is ethically inappropriate, according to the commentary to Canon 2B, to, on your own initiative, call up Rob or anybody else and say, I think X would be an appropriate successor for me or anyone else. You are only allowed under the commentary to Canon 2B to answer the telephone if someone calls you and says, hey, Judge, what do you think about X? And then in that case, according to the commentary, you are only able to offer an opinion or recommendation which is limited to the person's qualifications and factors relevant to the performance of judicial office, whatever that means. But that is what the commentary to Canon 2B say, and I know that the committee that is responsible for putting that commentary together would want me to clarify that point were they here. So, Mike, you work with the legislative branch. What do they have to say about all this?
Well, what I have to say, at least. Thanks, Judge Vaden, for the kind introduction. Thank you to the Federalist Society for inviting me to speak on this interesting topic. I guess I'd like to step back and think about how it actually plays out. I guess starting from my time as a clerk on a court with many senior eligible judges, to my time as a staffer to a senator with many home state vacancies, to my time at DOJ, time in the Judiciary Committee and with Leader McConnell, I think I've been able to see how judges think about this from all the different vantage points, most of them. There are these three or four instances that have made press. Honestly, I think it happens behind the scenes a fair amount, and I bet it has for decades. You just don't really see it. And I think Rob has done a good job of showing what the ethics rules likely allow and forbid, and I don't think judges typically find themselves on the wrong side of that. But nevertheless, judges do often behave strategically when choosing how to retire, and I think there's a number of reasons for them doing this. Most of them are good, some of them are bad. And I think there's a number of ways they operationalize it, and also mostly good, some bad. So why would a judge want to choose his successor? I think the clear answer is to preserve a legacy. Sometimes it's a personal legacy, such as wanting a clerk or family member as a successor. Sometimes it's also a public-spirited one. That seems fine. A jurisprudential legacy, for example, would be wanting to be replaced by a fellow liberal or a fellow originalist. Or it could be a broader public legacy, seeing the job as, I want my community to be served by someone who's at least as effective as I am at serving it. That seems entirely honorable. Of these three, I think the personal legacy is the most difficult to justify on its own. It goes without saying that insisting on replacement by one of your relatives is probably not sound. It luckily almost never happens. I recall getting word only once when I was at DOJ that there was a judge willing to go senior if replaced by a relation, and obviously it went nowhere. More common, you see judges wanting to be replaced by their clerks, especially these days. In some cases, it actually makes sense. Saying you need to be replaced by one of your clerks works if, in a fair estimation of who the best replacement would be, it's one of your clerks. So, for example, the great Judge O'Scanlan in Portland was, I'm sure, very excited to be replaced by his clerk, Danielle Hunsaker, now Forrest. But when trying to find a good pick in Portland, we would have been crazy not to start with the O'Scanlan clerks. And we did. First, Ryan Bounds was nominated, who fell victim to a grave injustice. And then Danielle Hunsaker was appointed. And frankly, these were the best picks available, and they were O'Scanlan clerks. I think we did the right thing there. In most cases, though, the desire to be replaced by one of your clerks probably doesn't have that kind of independent justification, and so it's probably a little bit more suspect. So leaving aside personal connection as being generally hard to justify, I think it's best to look at how judges should approach this on two axes, jurisprudence and professional background. Jurisprudence is pretty easy to understand. Does a judge want a replacement who will share his jurisprudence? Most do, not all do, but most do. If you're a judicial conservative, you will then probably retire when you have a Republican president and a Republican Senate. If you're a liberal, you retire with Democrats in charge. During the last administration, it was clear that a number of judges timed their departures to align with the confirmation calendar so that we could replace them. The same is obviously true in the current administration. This time last year saw a rush of prominent liberal circuit judges looking to get out on the last sure train before the midterms. It's just how it works. There's nothing wrong with this, and I don't think anyone seriously disagrees that there is. Professional background, on the other hand, is a little bit more controversial and a little harder to define. Should a judge have a say in the kind of lawyer who replaces him? Young versus experienced, judge versus lawyer, state versus federal, geography. These are the sorts of things that tend to come up when judges hold out for specific kinds of replacements that aren't due to jurisprudence, and they can be a little tricky. For example, for decades, there was sort of a cursus honorum for judges. You reach the top of the legal profession in your jurisdiction, then you become a state judge or maybe a magistrate judge, then you become a district judge, and then you cap off your career as a circuit judge. More recently, the trend has been to find a young, talented state solicitor general in a Republican administration or a young, ideological public defender in the current administration and just plop that person in for a lifetime appointment. Now, each approach yields different kinds of judges, and it's not unreasonable for sitting judges to have preferences between them. The fact is that in most jurisdictions, the federal judges are the apex predators. They know the other judges, they know the lawyers, they know the law schools, they frequently know the politicians too. They're in an unusually good position to know who'd make a good successor, and that's why, as Rob said, their informal input is frequently sought by the decision makers, and it's even contemplated in the relevant ethics authorities. So as a general matter, it makes sense that they may try to exert influence when it comes to professional background. And they very often have, from their perches, a good sense of who's in the mix, right? And the judge typically doesn't have to wait for the FBI to be in the field to know who's actually being contemplated for the seat. So while in the end the appointment process is up to the president and the Senate, I think these kinds of background considerations are legitimate for a sitting judge. As a public servant, he's entitled to want his seat shepherded in a way that's best for his community. As Rob noted, citing Rehnquist, resignation is not a judicial act. I'd say it's a constitutional one, and it should be exercised for the good of the public. Professional factors like experience, professional background, temperament, and geography are reasonable considerations for the public good. Now, that doesn't mean the judges should be able to choose someone in particular. I think Rob and David are right that it is Rob is right that it's awful close to conferring a private benefit under the ethics rules. I think David agrees with that. I think it's also just inappropriate in countless other ways. Absent certain very small and insular jurisdictions where it might conceivably be the case that this there really is only one candidate and it's the one that the judge wants, it just doesn't seem acceptable from either a jurisprudential or professional background standard. Furthermore, in the end, it is the pick of the president and the Senate, and so it's not the judge. Structuring a retirement to guide the political branches in a favorable direction is different from telling them who the pick must be. Demanding someone in particular also almost never works. As a practical matter, it's a good way to have your stalemate ended by death or disability and to have your seat filled with a president who doesn't care about your input. So a judge who wants to prudently help choose his successor looks to work constructively with the president and his senators and not get into a game of chicken with them. Now, what about telling the president or the Senate who the pick can't be? That strikes me as basically fine. There are better and worse reasons for blackballing picks, but there are many possible legitimate reasons, too. Is he too inexperienced? Is he not a generalist? Is he a campaign crony of the senator? Is it a person of bad character? There are countless reasons why a judge might actually be in a good position to know, I do not want my seat to go to this person, especially if he hasn't gone senior yet. So just as no hand-picked replacement from a judge is entitled to be nominated to a seat, I don't think any hand-picked replacement from a president or senator is entitled to have a seat vacated for him. Now, again, that doesn't seem to happen all that frequently, and in general, a prudent White House or senator will try to find some sort of workaround or accommodation in that situation. And just like you can't make a judge leave, you just can't make a judge leave when you want him to, it's also best not to play a game of chicken with a sitting judge. So one recent development that I want to mention before I finish that I think is new and is a problem is judges taking public stances in the confirmation process. So far this administration, the Judiciary Committee has received four letters from sitting judges urging a confirmation vote on nominees, a vote yes on this person. In one case, a judge in Virginia wrote to the committee to support his replacement who had previously clerked for him. This same judge had a daughter confirmed, his own daughter confirmed to a court of appeals in 2021 as well. So maybe I'm out to sea and he should be giving this talk as a how-to, but it's a development. And in other cases, Democrat senators have asked Republican-appointed judges to bless, essentially, their liberal pick. So once a nominee, in my view, is in the Judiciary Committee, it's a political process, full stop. Judges writing public letters urging senators to cast their vote in particular ways is not appropriate. It's not sharing information about who'd be a good pick or who'd be a bad pick. It's political lobbying at best. It's providing political ammunition to one party at the expense of another at worst. I strongly suspect it's something we're going to see more of in the future because it has happened and it's so far worked. And so I think it bears scrutiny both from the Judiciary Committee and from commentators on the outside. Thank you.
Next up, we have Professor Blackmon, and I know he'd want me to note that we owe a great debt of gratitude to this panel for the late Judge Lawrence Silberman. Indeed, he was originally, before his untimely death, supposed to moderate this panel here today, as the topic on which Josh is about to speak was brought to the attention of the Judicial Conference and its ethical bodies through his diligent efforts. Judge Silberman held many roles throughout his impressive career. He was solicitor of the Department of Labor. He was a deputy attorney general. He was ambassador to Yugoslavia. And but of course, most famously, he served on the D.C. Circuit from 1985 until his death earlier this year. He was a champion of justice, and in his last year, he was still out there fighting for what he believed, from commenting on the situation in American law schools to commenting about the situation that we're left with given the Supreme Court's defamation jurisprudence. Judge Silberman was a giant of our profession. We miss him greatly, and we're doing this panel in his honor here today. Josh, the floor is yours.
Thank you. During the Scalia Memorial Dinner, Justice Barrett mentioned that Judge Silberman was going to be speaking on a panel, and this is that panel, so we'll be doing this in his memory. And in light of the judge's passing, my remarks will be a little bit different than I had originally planned. I am going to explore the relationship between judicial ethics and the separation of powers from Judge Silberman's perspective. Indeed, this topic perfectly distills Judge Silberman's remarkable lifelong commitment to maintaining the wall of separation, not between church and state, but between the judiciary, the executive, and the legislature. The District of Columbia has two regional courts, the D.C. Superior Court and the D.C. Court of Appeals. These regional courts are separate from the U.S. Court, I'm sorry, the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia and the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. The D.C. Home Rule Act created a very unusual process for selecting judges for these regional courts. The president can only select his nominee from a list of three candidates generated by the D.C. Judicial Nominations Commission. And if the president fails to choose one of these candidates, get this, the Nomination Commission can appoint the candidate for Senate confirmation. Yes, a group of advisors can tell the president who to nominate, and if he ignores them, they can override his decision and go right to the Senate. Even worse, the statute requires that one member of the commission shall be appointed by the chief judge of the D.C. District Court, and this member shall be an active or retired federal judge serving in the district. So not only is the president's appointment power constrained, it is constrained by a federal judge who is appointed by another federal judge. Beyond these apparent constitutional difficulties, the regime also creates ethical problems. A sitting federal judge is responsible for nominating people to prestigious regional court positions. This authority gives sitting judges power over the very people who wish to serve as judges. It is not difficult to imagine that attorneys who wish to serve in the court will go out of their way to seek the favor of nominating judges. Like everyone used to call Rob all the time, right, Rob? They call this judge. Moreover, possessing this power gives judges the ability to dispense benefits towards their friends while rejecting their enemies. The potential appearance of impropriety abound. Now, I can't fathom why any sitting federal judge would want to serve on this commission. But then there's Judge Emmett Sullivan. Judge Sullivan not only serves in the commission, he chairs the commission. Oh, and by the way, the president appoints a member of this commission who clerked for, you guessed it, Judge Sullivan, twice. And also, Judge Sullivan emails his colleagues saying, if you have any recommendations, please send them to me. I'd love to hear what you think. This is a position of great power. As Judge Silverman told me, Sullivan becomes the kingmaker for judges in the district, the gatekeeper, become a judge in D.C. In 2020, Judge Silverman filed a misconduct complaint against Judge Sullivan. Works in the same building as him, down the hall, in fact, right? Silverman concluded that the D.C. Home Rule Act cannot override the canons 4F and 5, which were mentioned earlier. Judge Sullivan sought an opinion from the Committee on Codes of Conduct of the Judicial Conference. By the way, the Judicial Conference has a bazillion committees. It's going to get confusing, so just hang on. So this is the Code of Conduct Committee of the Judicial Conference. Now, the committee divided. The majority determined that service was not unethical, but there was a dissent. A minority of the committee disagreed. The minority found that service on the commission can be both political and may compromise the independence of the judiciary by enmeshing it with other branches of the federal government. See, all three speakers are building up to this moment. This was laid out quite deliberately by our expert moderator. Judge Silverman appealed that decision to the Judicial Council of the D.C. Circuit, not the Judicial Conference, the Judicial Council, follow along. In November of 2021, right around this convention last year, Chief Judge Srinivasan dismissed the complaint. Almost immediately, Judge Silverman asked the council to review the chief judge's decision. Now, most of you probably know of Justice Scalia's classic dissent in Morrison v. Olson. But you may not know that Judge Silberman wrote the panel opinion that struck down the dreaded independent counsel statute. This was called In Re Sealed Case. And Judge Silberman referenced his opinion in this appeal. He said, "My concern about congressional encroachment into Article III should be of equal concern to all Article III judges." He added, "It might be noted that I have a very long-term interest in the separation of powers." Yes, you do, Judge. He did. Silberman added, "If Congress can authorize judges to behave in a fashion that the judiciary regards as unethical, that constitutes an encroachment of Article I authority into Article III." Silberman did not hesitate to criticize his colleagues. He wrote, this is again his colleagues, "The reasoning is so tortured and inexplicable, it is hard to imagine that any Article III judge could have written it." Ouch. Ouch. Sorry, Shree. Right. "Alas, the Judicial Council of the D.C. Circuit affirmed the ruling. Among other judges, now Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson gave it a thumbs up. There was a dissent from Judge Greg Katsas, who might be in the building, joined by Judge Nima Rao, who might be in the building, and Judge Walker joined in part. Judge Katsas recognized the obvious. For the D.C. courts, as elsewhere, judicial selection is inescapably political." Katsas is right. "And it is thus improper for sitting federal judges to serve on the D.C. nominating commission, just as it would be improper for them to serve on state court nominating commissions." Katsas is right. Right away, Judge Silberman noticed an appeal to the Executive Committee of the Judicial Conference of the United States. This is just this balkanized thing. I actually visited with Silberman in chambers, and he walked me through it. It's a mess. "The complaint was directed to the Committee on the Judicial Branch," another committee, "but this committee refused to grant any relief. The committee concluded, the Home Rule Act does not seem to otherwise damage the reputation of the branch or enmesh the judiciary in local politics." The very next day, Silberman appealed. This guy is a litigant extraordinaire as a federal judge. This time it went to the Executive Committee of the Judicial Conference. There's more. He warned that if the Judicial Conference affirms, quote, "it would be an injudicious attempt to sweep under the rug a politically sensitive legal question." Now, who chairs the Judicial Conference? Chief Justice Roberts. And Chief Justice Roberts would never, never sweep under the rug a politically sensitive legal question. Never, never. Shocked. I'm shocked, right? You're all laughing, so I think you get the drift. At that point, I had already invited Judge Silberman to moderate this panel and sit where Steve is sitting. And he immediately agrees, like, yes. And I was so pumped for this. This issue, like Morrison v. Olson, represents a very sort of impetuous vortex that Madison warned about in Federalist Number 48. All three branches collide. First, Congress enacted a statute that authorized a sitting federal judge to lead a commission that nominates other federal judges. And critically, when Congress approved this process, the legislative branch deemed Judge Sullivan's service as ethical. Indeed, the committee said, well, Congress, that's okay. That must mean it's okay. No. Second, the judicial branch is thrust into the political process, and as Mike, Rob, and David articulated, it's political. This is not just giving a recommendation, it's giving names. The judge gets to pick the winners and losers in the judicial selection process. And in the face of an ethical challenge, the judge can rely on Congress's approval of that process. Third, the president is constrained. He no longer has control of whom he nominates for federal judgeships. And if he attempts to exercise his executive power, he risks having a member of the judiciary override his power and submit a different name to the Senate for confirmation. Can you imagine? I will close with Judge Silberman's words. As Justice Scalia noted, this wolf, albeit a small wolf, comes as a wolf. As with Morrison and other cases involving the separation of powers, this case is fraught with political implications, but judges have a duty to confront it without regard to such concerns or, for that matter, congressional reactions. On October 2nd, 2022, Judge Silberman passed away. Today, Judge Silberman's petition remains pending. I hope the judicial conference resolves it. I don't know if it survives him. I don't think it does, but we'll see. But regardless of what the judicial conference decides, I have a tip for the next president, whoever he happens to be. Deem this statute unconstitutional. Disregard whatever Judge Sullivan says and exercise your constitutional appointment power. Let the chips fall where they may. Thank you all so much.
Well, I hope you all are thinking of some good questions. I'm going to give our panelists an opportunity to respond to what each has said. But Josh, I have a question for you, and it raises an ethical issue that came to my mind as I was reviewing the facts of this case and what Judge Silberman put before the D.C. Circuit and the ethical bodies of the judiciary. You know, in your typical circuit, judges don't know each other. So if you're a judge of the Ninth Circuit and there's a district judge in eastern Montana, there's a good chance that you probably don't know him. So it's fair to say that one can be dispassionate because of that distance in reviewing an ethical complaint, if you were called to do so, on behalf of the Ninth Circuit. The D.C. Circuit, as you accurately pointed out, all the judges are literally in the same building. They see each other every day. And here you have one member of the D.C. Circuit acting as complainant against a member of the D.C. District Court. I think it would be fair to characterize that dispute as both serious, but potentially having a personal nature, if not because of the matter of the dispute, but because they know each other personally. And so in the judiciary, we do have the capability, if there is the appearance of a conflict, to refer such ethical complaints and investigations to another circuit.
Yes.
To ensure that the investigation is above board and the decision is made dispassionately on both the facts and the law as it may be. That clearly was not done with regard to this case. Do you know whether or not any party suggested that someone other than the D.C. Circuit should make the ethical determination in this matter, its judicial counsel?
Sure.
And separate and apart from that question, based on your own professional opinion, do you think the D.C. Circuit should have punted this to someone else to make the decision?
Sure. And thank you so much for that, Stephen. I'll read a sentence from Judge Silberman's complaint. He says, I do not criticize Judge Sullivan for having accepted the position on this commission. In other words, to quote the famous line from The Godfather, my complaint is not personal, it's strictly business. Article 3 business. So this case evolved throughout. Initially, Silberman didn't know what to do. He filed a request for an advisory opinion from the Code of Conduct Commission. They wouldn't give it to him because it wasn't his conduct. So the only way that he can get this started was by filing a misconduct complaint against Judge Sullivan. He had no other path to get it done. It went to this Code of Conduct Committee, and then Judge Sullivan released the opinion, which he can keep confidential. He chose to release it. At that point, the only play, as I understand it, was an appeal to the Judicial Council of the D.C. Circuit. I don't know that he ever requested another circuit to look at it. When there's a circuit judge as a subject of complaint, it does usually go to another circuit. But for district court judges, I do not think it does. But this is a weird thing because, again, Judge Sullivan would solicit his colleagues for recommendations who to pick because he's the kingmaker. So I think it was very inappropriate to have this court look at it altogether. And with respect to Judge Srinivasan and the others, their analysis was so cursory, it would never fly for an Article III judge opinion in either context.
Thank you for that, Josh. Well, now with that, I want to turn it over to some of our other panelists and see if they have reactions to what I've said, or if anyone wants to defend the decision of the D.C. Judicial Conference in this matter, feel free to do so. Rob, any thoughts on your end?
No.
David?
I'll be the loquacious one. So I guess I can add a few things. One is I would say that in an ideal world, judges would make retirement decisions independent, I think, of the party controlling the White House or the Senate. And I would actually be curious about how this has evolved over the years. I'd be interested in looking back at someone who is a research assistant, like a professor in the audience. Maybe you can have them do this. I'd be interested in seeing whether there's been an increase in judges who take senior status and depart office rather than passing away, like whether they do that in more commonly in when the presidency is controlled by their party, the party that nominated them, as opposed to the other party. I'd be curious because I would suspect that that has increased dramatically over the years. As Mike was mentioning, we saw just a slew of judges who, once Biden took office, went senior after holding off on that for a long time. So I'd be curious, actually, just has this changed over the years? I suspect it has. On the second point, a second point I wanted to make was, again, I don't know that you necessarily need a judge's input for some of these things. So for example, Mike mentioned my former boss, Judge O'Scanlan, and how two of his former clerks were nominated to succeed him, Ryan Bounds and then Daniel Hunsaker. And his input might have been helpful, but you didn't need Judge O'Scanlan to tell you because there aren't very many conservative lawyers in Oregon. So I don't think you needed.
It just happened to help clerk.
You didn't need, despite Judge O'Scanlan's wisdom, and he was supposed to be here and couldn't make it this weekend, I don't think he was necessarily really needed for that process. And then on the issue that Josh was talking about regarding this totally bizarre situation involving the D.C. courts, you know, I am very troubled by it, and I'm glad that Judge Silberman was fighting this good fight, and it was very in character for him. I wrote an in memoriam piece for Original Jurisdiction, and I got to interview Justice Barrett for it, and she just talked about how he was somebody who, when he saw injustice, he would make a ruckus about it, even if it would ruffle feathers, even if probably made things awkward in the judge's cafeteria or what have you, but I really think that it was the right thing to do. And here, I think some people might say, or I think it has been raised, well, these D.C. judges, are they necessarily officers of the United States? They're not Article III judges themselves, even if you might call them federal judges. But that really is besides the point, because the Judicial Conference has already interpreted Canon 5, the one restricting prohibiting political activity. They have already interpreted that to say that federal judges can't sit on commissions that help pick state judges. State judges aren't officers of the United States or anything like that, but that's still regarded as a political process that judges should not get involved in. So anyway, I'm grateful to Josh for explaining this, and you can dive deeper into it. It's a weird and I think troubling situation.
Mike?
On David's first point about how he suspects you'll see more judges electing senior status during the administration of presidents who appointed them, I think that's probably right. I think there's probably a lot of explanations for it, though. I think it probably, if you look at that and if that's the case, it probably starts with the judges who were appointed by Carter. I think judges before Carter, it was sort of before you really had like a real Brennanist wing of judges and before you had real originalist conservative judges. I think judges picked by Kennedy, Nixon, Johnson, these guys, it is very background-based. Like, I want a prosecutor, I want someone who knows the community, things like that. And so there just aren't necessarily those ideological or jurisprudential valences with them. So I think starting with Carter and with Reagan, you get more intentional jurisprudence in the selection of these judges, which makes them care more about the jurisprudence of their successor. And then I think the other reason you see it over time is that might be what Carter wanted and what Reagan wanted and what Clinton wanted and what Bush wanted, but as long as you had the filibuster in place, you couldn't necessarily get those judges. As long as you had a strong blue slip for circuits in place, you couldn't necessarily get those judges. So even between Carter and then the Harry Reid killing of the filibuster, I think you have a lot of judges who aren't necessarily as wedded to the jurisprudence as you have Nat then. And so I think the late Obama, Trump, and Biden judges are a lot more wedded to the relevant jurisprudential values because of Harry Reid's abolition of the filibuster. And so I think that's what you're seeing the movement towards.
I actually have the numbers on that from Trump and Biden. So 90% of Biden's circuit judges have replaced Democratic circuit judges. For Trump, 34 of the 54 circuit judges replaced Republicans. I think that's 63%. So I'm not very good at math, but I think that's 27% more Biden appointees are replacing nominees of their own party than during Trump.
Wow.
Before we turn to the audience, I have one more question that I want to press to the panel to try to tease out a distinction that I don't think there was disagreement on among the panelists, but it tickles at me. It seemed as though there was unanimous agreement among the panelists who addressed the issue that a judge cannot appropriately condition his retirement on the White House's naming of a successor, of a specific successor. But it also seemed as though there was agreement among the panelists that the judge could do so indirectly in the sense of giving a conditional senior status notification to the White House, seeing whom the White House nominates, and if you really hate that person, pulling it back. Usually in the law, we say that what's illegal to do directly, mm-hmm. you can't do indirectly. I'm curious why the sense among all of the learned people on this panel is that in this case, that is not true.
Rob, let me ask a question. So Congress doesn't have to get senior status. That's completely by it's a virtue, it's a benefit. What if Congress passed a statute saying you are only eligible for lifetime pension if you follow these procedures to take senior status, which is you give a letter with a date certain that you cannot revoke. If you revoke it, good, you say active service, and you can have a full caseload for the rest of your life till you die, but you cannot get these benefits of, you know, keeping your salary by doing, you know, nothing. Do you think that would be a constitution? Judges never do nothing, I'm sorry, but you know, much reduced load. Do you think that would be a valid statute, Rob?
I don't know that the judge has to cooperate.
But then he won't get the benefits of senior status. He just can keep a full caseload, and if he doesn't, then...
Changing the salary would offend Article 3, wouldn't it?
Okay.
On Judge Vaden's question, I actually... Again, I don't know that there's a legal recourse, but I do think it would be inappropriate and unethical for a judge to do indirectly what they couldn't do directly, namely condition their departure upon picking a particular successor. I think the question here, as is often the case in matters of, say, constitutional law, is, well, maybe there's this right, or maybe there's this thing that ought to happen a certain way. What's the remedy? And that, I think, is admittedly a tricky situation, and there's a weird situation involving, well, how much can Congress appropriately tell the judiciary about how to conduct matters relating to, say, court administration? Certainly, whenever there have been issues about judicial misconduct, the judicial branch uses separation of powers to say, Congress, let us deal with this. And so there is that concern about Congress getting too involved. I will point out that senior status itself actually is a creature of statute. I believe it was created by Congress in 1919. So this was not something that the judiciary came up with. And so there is precedent for Congress coming in and setting up certain rules relating to how judges leave. And as long as their salary isn't diminished, you know, when you're senior status, you still get your same salary. There's no constitutional problem. So again, it could be really interesting to see how far Congress could go in trying to regulate this. Personally, as I've said, and as Lori and I said in our WSJ piece, I prefer the judiciary to kind of clean up its own act, but if it doesn't, maybe Congress will have to act, and then we'll have some interesting separation of powers issues.
Yeah, I think in the end it is sort of a separation of powers question. I think judges can do this. I don't like it when they pull letters, especially after someone has been nominated. I think that's all very public. I think it does get very close to politics, because once the nomination papers have been received by the Senate, we've got a live political exercise at hand. So it is best for them not to do it. I don't know if there's a remedy for them doing it. And so just as a functional matter, there aren't really, I think, any real formal violations here. And so I don't like the look of it. And as a functional matter, it'll be better if they sort of kept their own house on this. But that said, all of these things are essentially interbranch conflicts, which, as you know, fitting that we're talking about D.C. and the D.C. Circuit and all that, if you read any D.C. case about interbranch conflicts, it's just about let's wait long enough for this conflict to go away, and then one party will prevail over the other. That's essentially how all of this, I think, as a functional matter, works.
All right, enough from me. Let's hear from our audience.
Hello, my name is Jad Mills. I'm in private practice in Seattle, Washington. whereas you know at the other conservative legal bastion on the West Coast. My question is about contingent judicial retirements. So say a judge is opposed to simply saying upon confirmation of my successor, if the offer was time limited, for instance, during this calendar year, during this particular Congress, during this particular presidency, what are the ethical implications of that? Thank you.
Well, I can tell you it's happened like that. Judge Randa on the district court in eastern Wisconsin, district court judge, conditioned his retirement upon retaining the Senate, was it?
Yeah, the confirmation in the Republican Senate.
Yeah, basically retaining a Republican Senate. That condition did not happen in 2006, and so I guess on one hand you could argue that the condition expired on its terms. However, Judge Randa did send a follow-up letter confirming that the condition did not materialize. So whether that is a withdrawal or not, I guess, is a legal question. I don't think it's withdrawal because the condition was not satisfied. As to ethical issues, I mean, I don't think there are any, but maybe my co-panelists disagree.
I don't necessarily think there are ethical issues with it. I would not encourage judges to do it in the future. It doesn't look great. It all worked out fine, but there are better and cleaner ways to do this.
This is an area where we don't want innovation.
Professor?
Steve Calabresi from Northwestern Law School and co-founder of the Federalist Society. I teach comparative constitutional law, and I can tell you the nightmare that we're headed toward, which is the situation in India, Israel, and the United Kingdom, where the Supreme Court justices in those countries pick their own successors. Mm-hmm. And in India in particular, the Supreme Court of India successfully held unconstitutional a constitutional amendment that overturned the power of the Supreme Court of India. So India is in part a judicial oligarchy rather than a democracy, especially given that the Indian and Israeli Supreme Courts are extremely activist. In the UK, in all three countries, Supreme Court justices help pick lower court judges as well. And in terms of strategic retirement, I had a colleague who once did a study of judges who had died in office, and he discovered that judges tend to die in office during the term of a president of the opposite political party who appointed them. So judges strategically die in office. And of course, we saw that with Justice Ginsburg and sadly with Justice Scalia. I think that one problem with strategic retirement at the Supreme Court level is that it gives so much power to the justices to perpetuate their legacy. I would love to see a fixed term, either 18 years or even 27 years, which is the average tenure that the justices now serve, just to lower this ability of the justices to pick their own successor. As to the lower federal courts, I believe it was Franklin Roosevelt in the New Deal who came up with the idea of paying a full salary to senior judges in order to encourage pre-New Deal judges to take senior status so they could be replaced by New Dealers. I have heard complaints from a number of friends who litigate, including Brent Hatch, the son of former Senator Orrin Hatch, that many of the cases he tries around the country are before judges who've taken senior status who are mentally incompetent, and that this is a very serious problem. Every other country in the world that I'm aware of has either term limits for judges or a mandatory retirement age. We can't do that without an Article III amendment, which would be impossible to obtain. But we might be better off if we simply abolished senior status altogether and said you can work for life as long as you're able to do a full caseload, and when you're no longer able to do that, you have to go. So I'd just be curious for any of your thoughts on any of that.
Yeah, I have a few quick thoughts. First of all, Professor Calabresi, I totally agree with you about Supreme Court term limits, and that's something that has broad support on the right and the left. And I know that you and your friend, but ideological opposite, Professor Amar, have written and spoken very eloquently about that. I totally agree with that. And some of the materials that we've collected for the CLE panel explore the connection between this issue of strategic retirements and the broader issue of how we structure the court. Professor Ray's article is a good one on that. On the second issue about older judges and mental competence issues, I should have put in the materials a piece by Ryan Barber of Insider. It was part of a larger series that Business Insider did about the gerontocracy, how so many branches of government and so many agencies and so many other aspects of the federal apparatus are run by really, really old people. And no offense, I'm going to be an old person myself. I am an old person already. It's troubling, and there are a lot of issues. And it's one of these issues where I think the judiciary has not done a great job of self-policing, quite frankly. There is a piece that Ken White wrote about his experience clerking for a judge who was sadly no longer competent and a not so very functional alcoholic. And this, you know, Ken is also older, so it's happened a long time ago, but he went to the chief judge, he went to the judge's wife, he went to other people, and everyone just kind of shrugged their shoulders. So the issue of judicial disability and competence is a very serious one that is wrapped up into this issue and really needs to be addressed. I'm not sure how I feel about abolition of senior status. It does have some burdens, it does have some benefits. My fear is that it will just cause many judges to grip on with, you know, like pry this commission from my cold, dead hands, rather than right now, where you can have judges who are still very competent, very hardworking, but they say, you know what, like my own judge, Judge Scanlon, has been senior status for a number of years, and he's still great, and he can go down to 50%, and he and Maura can travel, but he can still contribute very meaningfully to the judiciary. So I am concerned about the baby bathwater issue, but I'm very open to discussing that, and I would love to see some kind of empirical type of work to see, like, well, what happens if we abolish senior status. That would be very interesting.
Thank you.
Professor Calabresi, thank you for coming to our panel. I just want to make two comments. I think it's a third of the cases in federal courts right now are being handled by federal judges, senior judges.
Yeah.
So I think that would be a big loss there. I guess it falls to me to defend the courts again. and as for the issue of competency, I want to make sure everyone knows this. Every year, the chief judge of the court where senior judges sit must certify that any senior judges on the court are competent to proceed for yet another year. So it's not like these judges are just doing whatever, you know, free from any constraint, however long they want. I mean, every year it's up to the chief to certify them. So if folks feel chiefs aren't adequately dealing with this, that's one way to do this. But I just don't want people to think judges are running around without any control.
There are processes in place to ease them out of it. And I think, as I understand it, talking to chief judges, people do get eased out of it. You just don't necessarily, it's not always like, you know, the Judge Posner situation in Chicago where it's all out there in public. Right. And it kind of, I should have noted at the outset, my comments here are my own and do not reflect Leader McConnell. I will make one exception though. Supreme Court term limits are a terrible idea and he is fiercely opposed to those, so.
Thank you.
Well, Professor Calabresi, there's one note you want, and anyone interested in this topic may want to look at. The situation you described in India and the United Kingdom actually does exist here in the United States, in the state of Illinois. Under the Illinois state constitution, it's a default. The state constitution specifically says that the state legislature can change this. So far, they have chosen not to. But if there is a midterm vacancy on the Illinois Supreme Court, the justices themselves choose who fills the empty seat from the appropriate Supreme Court district. And the way that appears to work in practice is the justice who is retiring, who represents an electoral district, there are three from Chicago, and then the remaining seats are divided up among the rest of the state, chooses the person who will literally succeed them, and the rest of the court ratifies it. So it does happen in the state of Illinois.
Thank you.
This is kind of a non sequitur, but regarding Rob's point about chief judges certifying, and I will say that I think it's gotten a lot better over the decades in terms of chief judges behind the scenes easing out colleagues with issues. It'd be really funny if you could have some kind of like reality show kind of thing where like, okay, the senior judge has to, here are briefs. You have like 4 hours to write an opinion without any clerks, and you have to do your own Westlaw research. And like, can you imagine these judges like hunting and pecking and like, oh my gosh, can I write a 3-page mem dispo in like 4 hours without clerks? Like, and if you can't, like you're off the island. Like it would be very, that would be very interesting. I wonder how many judges would pass that test.
If Senator John Kennedy ever became chairman of the Judiciary Committee, I'm pretty sure that's how we do it.
Yeah. draft a ruling on a motion in limine.
Professor.
Gregory Dolan from University of Baltimore. For my question, actually a quick point to Judge Baden, it's actually much the same way it works in New Jersey as well, when there's a vacancy and there's recently, it's a 7-judge court. There's recently been 3 vacancies because of the loggerhead between the governor and the legislature. It's really the chief justice who keeps picking the pro temp justice. They've tried to kind of to make it neutral by picking the longest serving appellate justice, but nevertheless. To my question, and mostly, I guess, directed to David Latt and Professor Blackmun, mostly because they seem to have the most problem with what is happening, right? I wonder how do you feel and what do you think that there's any concern about it going in reverse? So there were some rumors, whether true or not, is not relevant, I guess, so much to the issue. That, for example, the Trump administration tried to coax some federal judges, including potential Justice Kennedy, again, doesn't matter whether it's true or not, by essentially promising them, right, that they'll appoint people that those judges, justices will like. And essentially enticing them into retirement, say, look, don't worry, your legacy is going to be protected. Is that a problem in any way? If it is, is it more of a problem than if judges come the other way, saying, appoint somebody that I like so that I feel my legacy will be protected, right? So, because in some sense, it's the same thing, right? But my question is, does it matter who starts that conversation?
So it's very interesting. Professor Dolan was also recently Justice Dolan. He took leave from the faculty to serve on the Supreme Court of Palau. So ask him about that experience. It's very interesting. Palau is this tiny little tropical island nation that is not far from my ancestral homeland of the Philippines. But anyway, be that as it may. I am less troubled by that, partly because of, I think, what Judge Vaden was saying about Canon 2, in the sense that there is this distinction drawn between the political branches kind of the political branches politicaling versus judges sort of doing this. At the same time, like I would say about a lot of the stuff we're hearing about, maybe it's not illegal or unconstitutional, but it's not a great look.
Yeah, I'll add a few points. It's not new. President Trump, oh, Rob, what, was an ambassador to Argentina, am I getting the country right, for Judge Prado?
Or Judge Prado became the ambassador to Argentina. Yeah.
Right, so
he likes the tango.
it's a cushy exit, a parachute. Before that, I guess you have President Johnson dangling the ambassadorship to the United Nations to Arthur Goldberg to open up the seat for Lyndon Johnson for Thurgood Marshall. I think presidents are allowed to be crafty, are allowed to be political. When they were trying to get Justice Kennedy to retire, there were stories, but we have these guys. You got this guy named Brett Kavanaugh. We have this guy named Rick Kethledge, who clerked for Kavanaugh. They'd be good replacements, wouldn't they? I'm not terribly troubled. I think David's right. When it goes from the president to the judge, I think it's less bad than going from the judge to the president, but I guess things always get a little blurry in the record, a little bit fuzzy.
Next question.
Thank you. My name is Morgan Brungard. I work in the Louisiana Solicitor General's office. Prior to that, I was the law clerk to the Codes of Conduct Committee from 2018 to 2020. As you can imagine, most of that experience is confidential. What the panelists, I'm sure, know, what other people may not know, is that a judge can request an advisory opinion from the committee as to whether contemplated conduct fits within the codes or not. As the name suggests, those opinions are advisory. There's really no enforcement mechanism. And a judge can also not request an opinion for another judge and say, hey, my colleague over here is doing something that I think doesn't comply with the codes. That also isn't allowed. There's been lots of comments about the judiciary cleaning up its own house. I'm curious how it could do that under the current framework, as the advisory opinions are not enforceable, and ideas for what other mechanisms might be put in place. Thank you.
That is a tough question. And I do think that we've seen some progress in the sense that when judges are reviewing the conduct of other judges, often, say, circuits reviewing misconduct allegations against a district judge or something like that. I think for many years, those did tend to sweep things under the rug. I feel that as we've been paying more attention to the judiciary, those opinions have sometimes come out the other way more often, with the judge getting some kind of significant sanction or some kind of tongue lashing or what have you. But again, a lot of this is just sort of like moral suasion and public shaming and sort of the Brandeisian shining of sunlight as disinfectant. It's just so hard because we value judicial independence. That is a very important value. And trying to address problems with the judiciary while respecting the independence of that branch gets very, very tricky. So I'm afraid I don't have a great answer to this. I don't want to lard things up with like more committees and more commissions and more bodies and more opinions. I think it's just, can we use the ones we have in a way that has more teeth? I don't know.
Anyone else? All right, we've got 5 minutes left. I want to try to get through as many of the questions as we can. Next.
Yes, thank you. Paul Kaminar. I certainly sympathize with Judge Silberman filing the ethics complaint. I filed a number myself and was successful years ago against Judge Abner Vikva of the D.C. Circuit for going around being a member of the ABA, the Civil Rights Committee to law schools, getting them to join the ABA Young Lawyers section, and that violated Section 2B, lending the prestige of his office for a private group, although that does not apply as a precedent to the judges here that are on the Federal Society panel. My question, I guess, is to Josh, in terms of the misconduct process was not going to help here. Do you think there could be a court challenge in some respects? I'm thinking, Josh, you know, we worked on collaborated on my challenge to Robert Mueller under the Appointments Clause. Could there be a challenge if Sullivan appointed somebody and a litigant wanted to challenge that? I'm thinking of the Supreme Court argument I made against the ABA for being a gatekeeper, violating the Federal Advisory Committee Act. The concurring opinion of Kennedy, Rehnquist, and O'Connor said, no, the Congress cannot interfere with the president's appointment power, so the Federal Advisory Committee Act and any statute fettering the president's power cannot be effective. So how would there be some kind of a legal challenge?
I talked about this with Judge Silverman before he passed, and it's tricky, right? So one way to tee it up is, again, as I said, the president just goes to forget you commission him, appoint whoever I want, and dare Judge Silverman to challenge him. He probably wouldn't. You might also take a litigant, either criminal defendant or a civil litigant, who has an adverse judgment rendered by a judge appointed pursuant to Judge Sullivan's commission. Standing might be tricky because you'd have to show that the constitutional infirmity led to the appointment of this judge, whereas maybe the president just treated it as advisory and picked him anyway. There's also the de facto officer doctrine, which is non-trivial, where even if you win at the end, the court just might say, well, de facto officer, everything's fine. But then you might get a declaration of unconstitutionality. So I think it can be done. I think it should be done. I don't know the standing arguments. They're a little murky.
Next.
Hi, I'm Josiah Rutledge. I'm just a 2L, but I'm wondering, Mr. Latt, about your interpretation of Canon 5 and whether it allows any room for courts of law to appoint inferior officers, and if not, wouldn't that interpretation just render Canon 5 unconstitutional?
Oh, in terms of things like district courts appointing a U.S. attorney or something like that?
Like bankruptcy judges.
Oh, I see. I think that I would draw a distinction between judicial officers versus things that have been, I mean, there's maybe this sort of weird positive, like things that are, I think there's a distinction I would draw between sort of people who are part of the operations of the court, like magistrate judges or bankruptcy judges or law clerks or what have you, and I don't think we would view those processes as political, whereas things that are constitutionally consigned to the other branches are political. Now, we could kind of take a step back and say, well, what is the meaning of political, and why are some things political and some things not political, and what is the definition of politics over pertaining to power? Well, there's power exercised by these bankruptcy judges. Like, I think it could get very weird here, and then you can then talk about modes of judicial selection, and should we have merit selection? I mean, again, I'm kind of rambling here, free associating, but I guess my short answer is I don't think it runs afoul of Canon 5, but I think that we could get into like very weird debates about why and what we describe as political in violation of Canon 5, and why are some appointments deemed political and some not? I guess it's kind of not terribly responsive, but I have to confess I haven't thought as much about that issue as I would like.
Thank you. All right, we have time for one last question, and that will be it.
Catherine Eschbach. So this is an ethics panel, which means it's a rules panel and a line drawing panel. And the two clear rules I've heard today are don't pick up the phone and don't publicly name who you're conditioning your retirement on or senior status on. But being down in Texas, what I've heard they've advised the students at UT when they take their ethics exam is the correct answer is, what would Jesus do minus one? And so I'm wondering for y'all, and I think there might be some disagreement, is what is the what would Jesus do minus one answer? Is it okay for a judge who's thinking about it to say, ask, okay, who's currently in the pool before my senator's judicial nominating commissions? Or is it okay for them to say, discuss with one of their more politically connected clerks that they're considering doing this, knowing they're going to scurry back to their friends on the SJC and say, oh, I just had this conversation with so-and-so and they're open to taking senior status but want XYZ. And so I guess I suspect there's some differences in how far out you think the boundaries can go of what political considerations are and what can be asked.
My recollection is when Jesus had a dealing with the judiciary, it didn't go well. But we'll see what our, we'll see. We'll,
goodness.
Well, we'll see what our panelists think.
I mean, it's what would Jesus minus Judge Jesus minus one do? I guess he would. I think first and foremost, I do think the motivations for why they're getting involved matter. And so as long as it is reasonable public-spirited reasons for it, I think it's probably fine, yeah, to see what the field is. And, you know, they know who's being talked about. They know whom to talk to. They know which clerk of theirs has friends who are elsewhere. And that's all well and good, and it's part of the system and functionally how it works. I don't necessarily have any problem with that. I think it's when it becomes a problem is the more it looks like personal benefit and personal reward is bad, and the more it starts to openly encroach on the political process, that's bad. So there are nominations out there, it's in the Judiciary Committee. I generally would find this kind of unsatisfactory. As a, you know, I like think of myself as a formalist. Rules are good, but again, these are essentially interbranch conflicts, and interbranch conflicts are one of the areas where sometimes clean lines and rules give way to practice and function, and I hate the word, but norms. And so I think if you responsible judges will maintain the norms of the profession well.
All right. If you'll thank our panelists, we can all go to lunch.